Wame, hello. It's been a little while. How are you doing?
It's been a long time. I am not okay, but it has nothing to do with anything but Mercedes.
Are they the bane of your existence right now? Are
They
they making
are.
you feel a little bit mad? But why? Actually, you know what? Like, why?
Because of the bad strategy calls, the bad tire, not tire management, the bad pit stops, and just that bad car. You know, I am even going to go on a rant here. Mercedes last year promised us, they promised us a rocket ship. That's what we like to call it. Like, they promised us a rocket ship, and that's what we've been looking for. You know, that's what we were anticipating all through like the winter break, and then come testing, we're like, okay, fine. In Spain, where we're like, oh, okay, fine, you know, yeah, when we might get a rocket ship, you know, Mercedes is like sandbagging. We go to Bahrain and we just see those timings and we're like, oh, what just happened? Where's the rocket ship that we were promised? First race, terrible race, but then we somehow get a podium and good points. Cool. We go to Jeddah. I feel like I've said a mouthful about Jeddah. Like, it's just, you know, yes, that was a terrible race. For, well, Lewis, but not like George, but it was a terrible race, and our pit stops were like dismal. The strategy calls, even on that race for Lewis Hamilton, were really dismal. And then from Jeddah, we go to Australia. We get to Australia. We seem to have improved, you know. We get there, we seem to have improved. We have hope. Finally, as a Mercedes fan, I have hope. I'm like, oh my God, yes, maybe they do. Maybe they'll give us that rocket ship that we were promised. You know, small steps is still progress. You know, like, let's just be patient with them. You know, we're still like very early into the season. We get to Australia. George gets lucky with the safety car, which he comes out in front of Lewis, which is okay. But then we're like, okay, fine, that's bad luck for Lewis. Well, we all said that Lewis has bad luck when it comes to safety cars given Abu Dhabi. Then we're like, okay, fine, we can take that. We go from Australia to Imola. That was just a dismal. It was just a very, 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 very terrible race for Lewis and just a terrible weekend for Mercedes as a whole. We're already like on the back foot, you know. We already don't have a fast car. At least let's have better strategies. Let's have better pit stops. But you get to Imola, our pit stops were like really terrible. We get stuck in a DRS chain, you know, and that car just isn't working with the driver. And then we go to Miami. We're like, they can't keep using safety car as an excuse. There's no way one driver has a better strategy for safety cars and the other one doesn't get the same treatment. I'm not trying to come up with a conspiracy or anything. I'm just saying that if you're in a team or a team of two, if one driver is going to start like is going to have a strategy around the safety car, why can't we do the same for like the other driver? Because it's a team at the end of the day. And then you look at the pit stops. Okay, in Miami the pit stops were not terrible, to be honest. They were just good, but it's still like a strategy call. And there's also this notion or like this narrative that's been pushed that apparently they gave Lewis an option. Well, they didn't give him an option. They were just trying. They left everything up to him when they told him that. When they told him that it's either he pits, like the choice is up to him basically. And you don't do that. You're the one with all the data. He's the driver. He's driving and he's under pressure with like he was. He's trying to catch up to Bottas with George behind him. So he doesn't know. He just feels like he just wants his team to tell him. And you read the radio you read the radio conversation between the two, and on paper when it's written down you feel like, oh, okay, fine, this makes sense, you know, that he was given the option and he was given advice, and then as he was given advice it was up to him to decide. But as you were listening to that whole conversation between the two, you can't do that to someone who's under pressure. You can't do that to someone who's just driving, who has no idea as to how other people's races are. You know, like, it's just very, very frustrating and very, very. I'm still angry, by the way, and I'm so sorry for going on this rant, but Mercedes just makes me angry because they don't have the fast car. The least they could do is have a good strategy and better pit stops. I can't believe this is the team that won 8 championships in a row. I really can't.
Yeah. I think the most telling thing about the Miami Grand Prix, okay, just there's just so many things, and there's so many things to like unpack about what you just said. Like, it's very impassioned, and I can appreciate like how you're feeling about that. I think with the pit wall thing, I just want to get straight into this, because I've seen in the last 24 hours, we're recording Monday night, South African time. In South Africa, the race was on Sunday evening. There seems to be a lot of sort of polarization about what has happened here. I think where we all tend to find common ground is that the pit wall messed this up. I don't think anyone could really reasonably try to shift blame on Lewis Hamilton, though some, I believe, have tried on social media, which seems mad to me because, as you rightly pointed out, he was out on the track. He doesn't have the data. He doesn't know how far behind certain people are. But I think it's very important to like try unpack this thing and understand it at the various points in time. When the virtual safety car came out, when Norris and Gasly had their collision and a virtual safety car was called, I believe, and I do stand to correction, that Russell was just a few seconds ahead of Lewis Hamilton, like, but like not much, like 3 seconds or something like that. On track, but of course Russell hadn't pitted. 12 seconds behind. Okay. All right. Fine. That's still fine. Right. It's very important to realize that a virtual safety car, everyone reduces their speed by the same percentage, right? So you go from a situation where under normal circumstances where you lose 20 seconds, for example, in a pit stop, you would now only lose 15 seconds in the pit stop in terms of where you'd come out in track position. So it's a relatively cheap pit stop. It's an absolute no-brainer for George Russell. And credit to him, because he played the percentages and he said, guys, why don't we just stay out for a safety car, right? And I think that was the right thing to do, because there was really nothing to be gained by him pitting before the safety car came out. Of course, he wasn't certain of it, but that's what I mean, that he played the percentages. There's been a lot of calls by people who I think are questioning why they did not double stack. First of all, I think a double stack is really, really difficult, even when teams are prepared to do it. It's almost impossible when the teams are not ready to do it. And given that George Russell was ahead on track from Lewis Hamilton, even though he hadn't pitted at the time, there was no benefit to Lewis Hamilton because Lewis Hamilton didn't have the tires. So George Russell was always going to pit onto fresh mediums. Lewis Hamilton would have been sort of 20 laps or 19 laps, I think, into his stint on the medium tires. I'm sorry, onto the hard tires. And it was believed by everyone, as evidenced by George Russell's stint, that once you get through the initial pain of the hard tire, it can become quite a good race tire. So given that Lewis Hamilton didn't have any fresh mediums and that softs, I don't know if he had new softs, but even if he did, they would probably have fallen away. There was absolutely nothing to gain, right? And taking risk of a double stack would have been silly.
Interrupt you on that.
Yeah, sure, go for it.
Interrupt you on that, because I think I was the one that actually was very vocal about the double stack. Remember, George pitted under the safety car, right? Cool, and which was a chip pit stop. So a double stack wouldn't have been that much. It wouldn't have been that difficult, because it was like everything was reduced, like the timings were reduced, and like no one wanted a fast pit stop either way. Cool, the double stack would have given each driver a fair chance to fight for their position, to defend their position. Okay, cool. George Russell was gonna have to come out before Lewis, because he pitted first, in terms of like the position of like the double stack, I'm guessing. And they would have just gone out on track at the same time, cool, which would have given the drivers a fair chance at fighting it out on track, not given one driver the disadvantage. And in terms of tire allocation, Lewis didn't have any new softs, which is cool, but he had one fresh medium. I think, yeah, he had like fresh mediums, and also he had two fresh sets of hard tires, one set of one new mediums, and no new softs at all. So he would have gone on the same medium tire that George Russell had gone, because when George got into the pits, he didn't go back to a hard tire, he went to a medium tire. So that would have worked. That would have worked perfectly, in my opinion. That's what I think. And I'm still
standing with that. I think we're going to disagree here. And unfortunately, I don't have my notes in front of me. So if I'm disagreeing with you and it turns out that I'm factually wrong, I promise you I will, you know, I'll put it out on Twitter and, you know, I'll have a drink the next time. So where I disagree is number one, because Russell hadn't pitted at, you know, just before the safety car, it would have... Lewis was the true leader, right? Because Russell has to pit at some point in time. If you double stack them, remember George Russell was ahead on the track. He would have got to the pit lane first. You would have then had George Russell on new mediums, fresh tires. And I don't believe that Hamilton had fresh mediums there, because he would have run some mediums in practice and he would have started the race on his medium tires. I don't think he had fresh mediums. So there was no advantage to be had. The fresh hard tires would have been slow. They would have taken forever to get up to temperature. And that's why staying on the used hards was actually optimal, because they'd gone through that painful process. So in that context, I don't believe there's any logic to the double stack. That notwithstanding, the way that, because so it's important to remember that was under the virtual safety car. Then it became a full safety car. And in this instance now, when the field is bunched up, all the time deltas have disappeared. You've now got on track, Hamilton is now on track ahead of George Russell, as he should be. But now Mercedes pit wall has a bit of a madness where they basically offer Lewis Hamilton the option of pitting. Again, given the tire choices, I don't think it was a good idea. But the point is not that they stayed out, which I think was actually the correct call overall. The point is that they created an incredible amount of confusion for the driver and seemed to put the decision on the driver, who had no data. Lewis Hamilton did not know who was behind him. And he was told it was George Russell. And he wasn't told that as the roll of the dice went, the way that Russell had, you know, played his percentages and, you know, his side of the garage had played the percentages in the race, even if Hamilton wanted to keep track position, it was inevitable that George Russell was going to pass him on track just because of the way that the cookie had crumbled. And I think the failure of Mercedes to communicate that clearly to him and, you know, give him, and, you know, to sort of not make the decision his to make was really poor. And I'm not sure, I do have a theory, but I also want to let you say what you want to say about that. Because I have a theory about how Mercedes have got there, but what were your thoughts on that, about them saying to Lewis, do you want to come in? We advise you to stay out, but do you want to come in?
I feel like it was such a stupid thing, because you're putting all the pressure on a driver who's just focused on his race. You can't ask, you have all the data, you have everything right in front of you. Lewis knows nothing. The driver knows nothing. The driver is only focused on his race. So asking him to make a decision about that, about the tires and everything else, is just really irresponsible. It's very dangerous because you're putting him under pressure and now he's going to panic. I'm not saying he panics a lot or anything. I'm just saying, as a driver, you're under pressure, you're stressed out, you're focusing on your race, you're trying to think of other things on how to catch your opponent as when the safety car ends or whatever, and your pit crew is on the radio telling you that we advise you to... It's like he was being nice. He's like, oh, Lewis, we're advising you to like stay out. But like, also, if you don't want to, you know... if you want to get in the pits, you can just come in, you know. We're not sure. What do you think? you know, it seemed like they were negotiating with him, or like they were just trying to get, like, take the heat off of themselves. And it's like, you are a strategist, and as a strategist, you need to be decisive. You can't leave it up to the driver. I get that Lewis, is a very, well, what's the word? Lewis is a very smart and talented driver, so sometimes he makes the right call. But it's in that situation, he just didn't have the data. He didn't know anything. He just only focused on his race. For the most part of the race, he's the person behind him was like 3 seconds behind him, so he just didn't know who was right there. You know, like even in his mirrors, he couldn't just see. So I just felt like it was just a damn thing. And I even read the conversation, like the radio conversation. And the more I read it, the angrier I got, because I'm just like, you are supposed to be this race strategist. You are just supposed to tell him, you know what, this is what's going to happen. And, you know, give him everything, like be decisive and be very stern. Give him the data that you have. Tell him what might happen. No, tell him what's going to happen, not what might happen, and everything like that. Don't just, that thing irritated me. I'm so sorry. I'm just irritated with the Mercedes strategist, quote unquote strategist, because I don't think those people are strategists. I feel like I can do a better job than that. Well, I'm joking, but like, I just feel like the other people, they can do a better job than that.
No, I don't think you're wrong. And something that I think, you know, we could go around this for quite a while, but I do think there's something interesting about the relationship between Hamilton and his pit wall. And I have to, please indulge me here. And I think I've tweeted this before, maybe most recently a few weeks ago. Verstappen's greatest strength, one of his greatest strengths, or rather one of the strengths that I don't think gets noticed about him, is how clear he is with his pit wall, right? He will, in very colorful language, tell them that his bloody front right is graining, right? You know, he may say it in colorful language, but he will tell them that that's what's happening. Or he'll complain about balance and how much understeer he is. But he communicates very clearly what's happening with the car. And he lets his pit wall take control. I think there is an element, and I just mean, so I want to be clear, what happened on Sunday, what happened yesterday in this race was a clear failure on the side of his pit, of Hamilton's pit wall. But I think the history of the communication between the two, Hamilton he's been famous for it, for playing bluffs, with playing messages, the bluffs of his tires, for example, where he says, oh, my tires are finished. And then he puts in purple laps and we're just like, come on, bruv, come on. Like, your tires are clearly not finished, you know. And you know, sort of trying to play mind games with the rest of the grid. And his pit wall has had to learn, I think, to their credit, you know, when to necessarily believe him or when to necessarily understand his slightly more cryptic messages. And he's also been very good at making decisive calls and, quite frankly, defying his pit wall at times. Now, I think that has led to this moment where the pit wall might not always feel like they're in control. Right. And I'm not saying that that's the right thing, but I think that there's an element of them thinking that he knows best. And that's how I think we've got here. And I think that someone within the Mercedes group needs to take control and say, hey, is it Vowles? Is it Bonington? Bono, like, you guys have just got to take control now. And particularly in the context of when Mercedes have, for the past 8 years, have been running right at the front of the grid, they have been able to benefit from conservative decisions. One of the, you know, people have always said for the past 3, 4, 5 years, oh, Red Bull are always a breath of fresh air, because what they do is they make outrageous calls. But that's because we were fighting for, you know, trying to maybe pick up the crumbs if there was a podium. There was nothing really to lose from a Red Bull perspective when they were in that position. And I think Mercedes do now have to defer more control to the pit wall and actually start to make more aggressive calls, because you can't afford to be conservative when you're not necessarily right at the front. I think that was a luxury that they had for some time. I think that's how we've got here.
I hear you, but you're wrong. Like you're wrong.
Yeah. Fair enough. But I kind of had to get those thoughts out there. Yeah.
Let me elaborate. As a pit crew, as a team, you know cryptic messages. I feel like you can discern between cryptic messages and other messages where you can hear that the driver's in distress. For example, Purple Lab, my tires are gone, Bono, and then he starts stating Purple Labs. That's just the tire thing. And I feel like the pit wall knows that. But there's no, like, your point about how Lewis has defined the pit group, has defined the pit wall, and it's played out to his advantage or whatever, is not really true. Because let's take last year, for example, in Sochi, when the infamous Sochi incident, when in Russia, it was Russia 2021, where it was started raining, the pit wall was like, Lewis, you're going to have to come into the pits for intermediates. And Lewis was like, no, I want to stay out, I'm going to lose track position. And Bono was like, no, you're going to have to come in. He was done with it, and Lewis listened. Like, he didn't want to do it, but he still listened. So, and all these other times, I was also watching Brazil 2021, best race of the last season, by the way, just wanted to put it out there. I was watching Brazil 2021 the other day, and the pit crew again is also playing around with the idea of like Lewis pitting or not. It's just like, if he wants to come in, which tire would you want? Like, they're leaving everything up to him. Last year, cool, they got away with it because they had a good car. You can't get away with it now because you don't have a good car. Like, I hear your chats about how, I can hear your chat about how Mercedes are like, how they got to this point, but I still feel like it's a lazy thing, because as a pit wall, you're supposed to be stern with your driver. If you have the data, as they do have the data, then they should just be stern with the decisions and not leave it up to the driver, not leave it up to a stressed and depressed driver. That's it. And I just feel like I've gone on and on about Mercedes for like 22 minutes now. We have to move on to the bland championship between that's happening.
Yeah, for sure. Listen, and if I could just wrap up, I fully agree with you that they didn't take responsibility, and your Sochi counterexample is very valid. I'm not trying to excuse what happened. I'm just trying to think to myself, how did we get here? Because these are guys who were paid, I don't know, millions of rands per year to be making these kinds of decisions. You know, they're in a high profile position and a high profile sport, and at the top of the team, you know, probably the single most dominant team probably in the history of Formula One. And I just can't reconcile that they just sort of became, I don't know if soft is the word or indecisive is the word, overnight. There has to be something that happened, but you're right. There's lots of different things. If you want to talk about the championship and the race in Miami in particular, compare that to Sergio Perez running P4, absolutely, you know, reeling Carlos Sainz in at the time, and then his sensor, one of these sensors goes, and he had a utter, meltdown. I'm being very harsh on the guy, but he was very upset. And his pit crew just kept saying to him, Checo, everything's okay. Even though his car was literally slowing down. What terrible time, you know. Checo Perez, Red Bull, once again showing that they are not the most reliable car, and it's nail biting. My Apple Watch yesterday, not during this particular moment, but during right after the safety car, it told me that my heart rate was up, by the way, and I was lying on the couch at like 11 p.m. watching a race, and my heart rate was up. What a disaster.
Well, that is something that I love to hear. Red Bull and Reliability, like, that's music to my ears. But yeah, that's a perfect example, actually, in terms of like the people and the decisiveness and the sternness that comes from them. Like, Checo was complaining and he was panicking about his car losing power, and the pit was like, no, you're good and you're okay. See, they calmed him down. They didn't add to his panic, and they didn't actually think, they didn't gaslight him into saying, Checo, no, you know, just focus on your race or whatever. They reassured him. They told him that the car, or they said they look at it. Then they actually did look at it, and they were like, you know, I know your car's fine and everything. So yes, you're right. But in terms of like Mercedes and whatever's happening there, really, I just feel like I've said enough and I don't have any more words. Personally, Mercedes AMG, Petronas F1 team, I don't have any more words to say to you guys. Like, I just genuinely don't have nothing. Like, I have nothing until you guys fix that car. That's if you also want to fix it. You know, I have to put out there that it has to depend on you guys. Like, it just seems like you guys are okay with that tractor that you built. So we'll just look at you guys from now on. You know, whatever you guys do will make us happy. And then we also have... I mean, before I wrap up this whole Mercedes chat, actually, the funniest thing that I've seen is how the fan base in itself is fighting each other. And it's the most funniest thing, because we have Team LH fighting the 63 fans who are saying that, why is it that Lewis is the only one who has bad luck? Which is actually something that, well, I'm not saying it's a conspiracy or whatever, but there is, you know, where the smoke is fire. I'm just saying that. And then you have 63 fans who are saying, well, why is Lewis always at the bad time? Or at what did they say? What did I read? Well, it was just something about bad time and whatever. But it was the funniest thing. Like, I just want to show Mercedes how them not getting their shit together has affected the fan base in itself, because people are fighting amongst themselves. And it's the funniest thing. Like, it's hilarious.
No, trust me, I can relate to that. I support Manchester United. And we've kind of gone full circle. We went through a large period of time, especially when Jose Mourinho was manager, of like a very divided fan base. You know, half of the fans deciding that, you know, Jose was the problem. The other half of the fans were just saying it's the players who are the problem. And we've been rotten for so long that everyone right now is sort of unanimously online. And I even think at Old Trafford, the sort of match-going fans are just like, no. Everything at the club has gone to absolute nonsense. So, I think you're at that Jose Mourinho versus his players stage of fighting. And I mean, you know, it's something to be expected. It's the nature of online. It's, you know, just because it's social media, you'll always find that sort of antagonism happening. And then, you know, when people are frustrated, because like you said at the top of this, so much of the frustration is born both out of Abu Dhabi, but also the promise of this year. Part of, you know, we're constantly reminded last year that, you know, Red Bull are throwing everything into the 2021 championship, and they're throwing all these upgrades to the 2021 car. And you know, Mercedes were saying, you know, we're done upgrading this car, we're focusing on 2022. So I understand that bit of frustration. But, you know, designing motor cars is difficult. Designing a Formula One car is difficult, and I'll save it for next time before I talk about where I think Mercedes are on a development path, because a team that up until this weekend that I thought was on a decent development path was McLaren, who have had a rotten weekend again. My boy Lando Norris, Gasly just commits utter terrorism, plonking his car in the middle of the track at like 2 kilometers an hour. Doesn't even look to his inside or to his left-hand side to check if there's a car there. Then Lando's just like, hang on, how has this happened? So that's his race ruined. Daniel Ricciardo you know, again, McLaren just struggled throughout this weekend. But like the reason I'm saying this is because I think the first episode, McLaren were supposed to be, were absolutely nowhere in Bahrain. And we thought, oof, this is terrible. But they sort of slowly started to get things back together. Of course, Lando takes a podium. Was it in Oz? Where did Lando take a podium? No, it was in Imola. After Charles Leclerc's madness. And you thought, okay, well, sweet, this team is now back on the upward trajectory. After Imola, I actually thought they might low-key be the third fastest car. Nope. Like, I think in our last episode, I mentioned to you that I just have no idea about anything that's happening with any cars except for the front three. I've got a pretty good idea about what's happening with the front three. But like from race to race, it's, you know, one weekend it's Williams right at the back. The next weekend it's Aston Martin. And then Sebastian Vettel has like a really strong weekend at Imola. Lance Stroll looked like he was going to have a strong weekend this weekend. And then Aston Martin just does a madness. Like, how are you seeing the season? Are you taking it in? Are you enjoying it? Are you enjoying the madness that's happening behind? Because I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, Alex Albon finished ninth. He finished ninth yesterday. And good on him, by the way.
McLaren are like practice merchants. They always top your practice charts. And then when it's time for them to actually show up during the race or quali, they just do. Like, they just pull stinkers. It's just, like, which is like really the funniest thing, because it's like McLaren are pulling a Mercedes as well. It's like, oh my God, we're going to give you hope during practice. You know, you guys are going to be doing great, you know, pulling purple fixes here and there, you know, everything like that. Come when it matters, like during quali or like during the race, they just pull stinkers and you're like, how? What happened now? You know, like where you guys are. In terms of like, how am I enjoying the race? I'm not enjoying the season, not because of Mercedes or anything, but this is a boring championship fight. Like, nothing is exciting. The overtakes between Max and Charles aren't exciting. They're just like, oh, okay, because Charles's bozo gene always gets activated when he sees Max in his mirrors or whatever, but we'll get to that. And then Aston Martin and just, well, basically this is Mercedes-powered cars, right? Mercedes-powered engines that we're speaking about. Aston Martin has this funny thing. I always see like the tire allocation. You know, Aston Martin never has a fresh new set of hard tires. Every time during practice, they use all their tires, which I think is like a good thing, but it's also terrible because why do you guys never have a fresh set of tires for both your drivers? And the drivers is a talent, well, quote unquote talent for Lance Stroll, that is kind of like coming through for them. But in terms of like the whole package, McLaren, Aston Martin is also like a disaster. It's a disaster in terms of how it's run, in terms of like its strategist, in terms of like how everything is there. Like, it's just a mess. And then Williams, I don't know where Williams are. Like, I'm just trying to figure out where they are. Well, I'm not going to count Latifi because to me, he's not a racing driver. But then you look at Alex Albon and like him always maximizing, I guess, the strategies and just like his car and like, you know, putting in the points and everything else. I don't know. They might have a good car, but it also has a lot of reliability issues, actually. You remember how it's always blowing up, like its brakes always blowing up? I think they did blow up also during practice this past weekend. So we can say that, I don't know, man. Like you said, I just don't know where the cars are. I think I know where the top three are. I don't even know which cars, like the top, which cars, like P4, because I thought it was Haas, funny enough. But Haas also is like really terrible. Like, it's good and then it's bad. Like, one weekend is like really great. Oh no, it can't be Haas. It's probably Alfa Romeo. I'm sorry, I'm rambling. But yeah, it has to be. I thought it was Haas at some point, but Haas will pull P4s and P5s one weekend, and then the next weekend is like it's like P12, P14, and you're like, how? Also, what's going on there? And then, but also Haas also has like Mick Schumacher, which was, well, I mean, Mick was having a somewhat decent race this weekend. Like, he was having a decent race.
Oh, yes. Did you just admit it?
I said he has like a decent race. And then he, Bozo Jean, got activated as well. So that conversation that I said we need to start it, because what was that? Like, he was doing good. I think he was finishing in the points. And then he started to drive into Vettel. Like, hello, Batung Ndor. Like, what's happening? You know? Like, I'm sorry.
I was heartbroken for him. I've got a soft spot for Mick Schumacher. He just seems like a nice kid, basically. Like, I think Vettel is like kind of like, Vettel's like a little bit older than me, but I can get why Vettel feels like Mick is his son, you know, this whole relationship that they have. And the fact that it was the two of them who decided to get into an entanglement on Sunday was utterly hilarious. I genuinely just laughed because Mick, you know, it would have been his first points, and this whole thing about not scoring points is going to weigh heavier and heavier on him until he does. I'm pretty confident he will, because the one thing that you were talking about, the Haas, I think the Haas is a very, very good qualifying car. I mean, K-Mag has put the car in the second row, third row, perhaps. He's put in some outstanding quality performances, but it does go backwards in the race. What do you mean, let's not get ahead of ourselves? I'm saying it's a good quality car. What do you mean?
Has he not
qualified fourth? Fifth, maybe. Come on, Kevin Magnussen, appreciation corner.
I'm not saying it's not a good quality car or whatever. I'm just saying he did not put that car in the second row. It was the third row. Let's not get it twisted. It wasn't the second row. It was the third row.
Dude, it's agendas over facts here. That's what we care about. It's all about agendas. And I've got a big K-Mag agenda. But but the reality is that in race trim, the Haas does seem to go backwards. The Alfa Romeo seems to have a better balance between quali and the race. You know, if they qualify sixth, you know, they might genuinely be fighting, as Bottas was, you know, right until, when did Bottas make his mistake? Was it after the safety car? But, you know, he was legitimately, why are you laughing at Bottas? Come on.
Because he kills me. He literally had that P5. And then Lance just, like, literally, he went out of the way for the Mercedes. But I saw his interview and he said that the reason why he made that mistake was because he could see the two Mercedes fighting in, like, his mirrors, and he just didn't want to be a part of that. I'm like, bro, you're a racing driver. What do you mean you don't want to be a part of that? But it's actually funny. Wait, I need to go back to what you said about Alfa Romeo and in terms of, like, it compared to the Haas. I have a theory about Ferrari engines. It's just a theory. Guys, don't kill me or anything. It's just a theory. Ferrari suffers from hectic reliability. And I'm not saying, no, the Ferrari-powered cars, right, suffers from also reliability, but we don't see it with, like, the front runners like we see it with, like, Red Bull powertrains. Because the Alfa Romeos, I don't think both Alfa Romeos have finished a race in the past 5 races. I don't think both of them have both finished a race, because it's always one over the other. And how the Haas also, sometimes one doesn't start and then sometimes one does start, or like they just lose power. But we don't actually hear those radio messages because, you know, no one takes Haas seriously. Okay, I didn't mean to say that. But
it's because of Gunther. You know, Haas are a fascinating, like, the whole dynamic around Haas really amuses me, because you've got this character, Gunther, who is almost a parody of himself now, you know, since Drive to Survive. We've got a few friends who were at the race in Miami, and a few of them had paddock passes and so forth, weekend passes, which was incredible. So, like, to see their content on Instagram. And, like, you know, a couple of them were, like, taking photos with Gunther, and I just laughed, you know. But he's clearly a very, very good team principal. And, you know, the struggles of 2020 and 2021 were simply because Gene Haas refused to put any money in the team. And it's really interesting because we now see that when the money is there, they're a very, very capable team. They're capable of producing good racing cars and getting decent hauls of points. And, you know, it would be interesting to see where they could be if Gene Haas, you know, was a bit slightly more ambitious. But anyway, it's not important. I think the observation about the Ferrari power units is really interesting for me. And I hope you're right, obviously, as the person who supports a team that is probably the most on edge at lights out every weekend, not because the car's not quick, but like you just hope it's going to get to the finish line. You can't win a race that you don't finish. So reliability is just such a huge thing right now. And interestingly, you know, the Mercedes power units, they seem to get to the end, right? They do. And especially the works team gets to the end.
Except the Williams.
Both of them. Except the Williams. Yeah, but Williams is, well, I mean, Latifi, you know. Latifi. Honestly, he's another parody of himself right now. Yeah.
Let me give him a huge shout out. Oh my God, Nikki, I'm so proud of you for not crashing this weekend. Like, it was a very narrow second with like so many like blind corners. I'm so proud of you for not crashing and finishing the race. Oh my God, Latifi. But I have a theory. Latifi only burns it when Max is not leading. If Max is leading, Latifi doesn't be in it. And I'm starting to believe people that say that Latifi was hired by Red Bull to be a weapon of mass destruction. Like, now I fully believe it. Like, that conspiracy, I'm fully with it, guys. Like, you guys were onto something.
I'm not having this, honestly. I'm not having this. But you know what? You can have your cake and eat it. Like you said, he didn't have to bin his car. Because Verstappen had one of the best weekends I think he's ever had. And I need to explain why this is the case. Verstappen ran, single-digit. Yep. Tuck yourself in, right? He ran like a single-digit number of laps on Friday in FP1. Didn't run at all in FP2. He got his running in an FP3, was still able to get on it and put the car P3 in quali, which in of itself, given this track, the track evolution, the lack of grip off the racing line, etc., was a really, 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 really good job. And then on his first start of the weekend, he didn't even have a single practice start this weekend. He gets an incredible launch. Take Sainz on the outside, a part of the track which, you know, was a bit wary. One was wary about how much grip there was there. And then proceeded to hunt Leclerc down in a very methodical manner, to then control the race from there, you know, pull out a gap that was enough to avoid the undercut so he could pit two laps later. I mean, the kid... I just have to say shout out to him because that was one of the best weekends he's put together, you know, within the context of no running, very little running on Friday on a new track. Like, yeah, I could, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, whatever. let's talk about Charles. I mean, you know what, guys, I'm not saying I hate Max, but I mean, I am, but like, I'm not really saying that. But, I mean, he did have a decent weekend. I'll give him that, you know, given everything that he went through. I mean, I give him that, but I want to start focusing on Charles, you know. There's not much to talk about when it comes to Max. I mean, like Lange said, like you said, you know, he'd had a decent weekend and that's it. I'm not going to say he had like... I'm not gonna stand on like on top of a mountain and like scream his praises. I'm not crazy. Like, I wanted to talk about Charles.
Yeah, that's good enough for me.
Like, I want to talk about Leclerc and how he's bottled two leads and two consecutive weekends. Like, what? You know, let me just make this clear. I only care about Lewis Hamilton. Everyone else really don't care. But I can cheer for other people, well, sometimes. And I was really cheering for Charles, you know, because anyone but Max. But as I was watching, like, his growth the past five races, that kid does just, like, he makes a lot of mistakes. Like, he just makes so many mistakes. It's just like, oh, my God, are you serious? And Imola, that mistake was so stupid. I'm just like, are you serious? Like, how are you spinning by yourself? Like, in front of your home crowd. But, I mean, that was a win for me because no one wanted to force a celebration. This isn't 2004, I'm sorry. but, like, what happened yesterday, he didn't even try to defend Max. Like, Max passed him and, like, he didn't even try to defend. And I'm just like, sir. And then when he was trying to catch up to him, he also just wasn't, like, his reaction time wasn't quick. And I'm just like, Max has a terrible start, and we all know that. But if you're going to have, if you're going to be worse than him, then what's the point? Like, you both can't be worse. Like, one has to challenge the other. That's why I keep on saying, like, that this championship is, like, this championship fight is so boring because, man, there's no challenge whatsoever. You know, like, it's so easy to predict, like, Leclerc's mistakes. You just look at him and you're like, you know what? I know he's going to make a mistake here. Like, you just know.
Okay, I think you've been very, very harsh on the kid. And you've had a few theories today, and I don't think this is what I'm going to say. I don't even think it's a theory. I think it's matter of fact. It's a battle of styles, and I think we're going to see some big seesaws swings this season in the championship. Because what's very, very clear is that the amount of downforce that the Ferrari generates is off the charts, right? It's probably on that level of Mercedes. And I think that is the reason that Ferrari and particularly Charles Leclerc are able to qualify so well, because when you've got so much downforce, you're able to put temperature in the tires quickly. And that's why they're performing so well in qualifying. That's my theory, at least. Whereas the Red Bull have gone for a concept that tries to generate as much downforce as it can from the floor of the car, and then left the rest of it to minimize aerodynamic drag, which is how they get so much top line speed. Now, the trade-off of that is that the comparative lack of downforce means that they can't really get temperature into their tires quickly as the Ferrari. And invariably, they will find themselves behind in quali. And so you've got this fascinating dynamic where Red Bull might have the fastest race car. In fact, they do have the fastest race car, but they will often start behind Ferrari. And I think that's always such a really cool dynamic to watch in a race. And I think you're being a little bit unfair on Charles in the race trim, especially at the last two tracks that we've been at, where the top line speed of the Red Bull meant that Charles was really a sitting duck, especially because, and this is quite surprising, the Ferrari, like, eats its tires alive. I think that's a very, not unique, but it's something that's starting to develop as a pattern, and they're going to need to get that sorted out, because one thing that Max did really, really well on Sunday, yesterday in Miami, was to simply wait it out. And as soon as Charles's tire started graining, he went for the kill. He didn't push it. He didn't, you know, try and overtake him or catch him as fast as he can. And again, this is just a slight sign of his maturity now, Verstappen. I don't know. And I find that really fascinating. And I think that you will see a lot of people seem to think that Barcelona favors Ferrari. I'm not sure, but I noticed Jenson Button on the Sky Sports said it, and a number of people online have intimated that it's a Ferrari leaning track. I'm not sure, but What I am absolutely sure of is that provided that neither of those two Ferraris put it in the wall at Monaco, they are going to drive off into the distance. And they'll probably do that at Hungary too. They'll probably do that at Mexico as well. There's still something in this. There's still something in this. I think yesterday's result, especially more than Imola, but yesterday was very track dependent. And luckily for Max, when the safety car came out, the top line speed was able to fight off Charles Leclerc, because that battle was fascinating. Again, the fact that Charles Leclerc was able to get his temperature into his tires so much quicker meant that Max was defending for his life for two or three laps before he started to get the tires up to temperature, and then he was able to pull away. I'm sorry, I cut you off before you were going to say something. I just had to try and finish that thought.
I mean, I'm not being hard on him. My fact still remains. I heard you, and yes, what you're saying makes sense. But all I'm saying is, given all of that and how the Ferrari eats up its tires or whatever, I mean, his racecraft can come into play here, where he can also try to manage his tires, which he's not doing at all. So I don't think I'm being hard on him. I'm just showing him I'm just pointing out his bozo mistakes, because some of his mistakes are so minor, but they're so costly to him, especially. Like, he just makes so many costly mistakes, but he just gives Max space to just run off into the distance. And I remember he said something funny when he said, given that the Ferrari boys don't bin it into the wall in Monaco, which we know that is impossible, and they're going to run off into the distance. I don't think that's going to happen. I really don't think that's going to happen. Also, I've seen with Sainz's car, right before the race, all the time, there's always like something with Sainz's car where, even yesterday, like, there was a thing where they said the mechanics were working on Sainz's car. So we go back to the whole reliability thing that I had about Ferrari's engines, but how they also might not be reliable, but we're not paying attention to that because, Alfa Romeo and Haas have always had reliability issues all these years, so no one's actually really paying attention to that. But I think also with Sainz's car, you can actually see that these people might also be suffering from reliability issues. And I mean, we'll see. I call it delusion or whatever. I have lost all hope in Mercedes, but I also have hope in Lewis, and I still feel like he is going to come back. And I just don't know when, but I know that in a few race time, we'll be speaking about how he had a really great race and he was P2 or P1. I mean, you can say I'm ambitious, and I know you're going to love it. But
not actually. I mean, I actually think that race is Monaco. I think the amount of downforce that Ferrari and Mercedes generate is off the charts. There's no long straights in Monaco. It's a slow track, as in, you know, there's very low top speeds. And if Mercedes are able to avoid porpoising, I don't know the data, so I'm not sure at like what speeds exactly the porpoising starts for the Mercedes, but if they can avoid it simply by the fact that the top speeds are not as high in Monaco, I wouldn't be surprised to see the Mercedes finish ahead of the Red Bull as well. I think Red Bull are going to be absolutely nowhere in Monaco with their setup, and I've already braced myself for that. I'm not even gonna laugh at you. I sincerely believe that Ferrari runs off into the distance, and I wouldn't be surprised if Mercedes got ahead of the Red Bulls at Monaco, and that's in two races time.
Bali, you agree with me? Oh my God, well, this is the first.
Yeah. Like, sort of first. yeah. Yeah.
There was something you said about Barcelona being a Ferrari track and whatever, and I don't think that's the case, because, first of all, Barcelona is a very bumpy track as it is, and given the porpoising that Ferrari also has struggles from, yeah, I don't think it's good for any car that porpoises a lot. Like, I don't think Barcelona is going to be good unless, if there's like floor changes, if Mercedes change that floor altogether, which I hope they will, because they said the first big upgrade is going to be in Barcelona, because I mean, that's where they ran the W13.1. That's where they ran it. So I think they're just going to compare the data to that. And they did say they're not opposed to bringing back the car with the side pause. I don't think that's actually possible, but like, I also just, I don't know. We'll see. I mean, that team, yeah, just stresses me. But the point I'm trying to make is that I don't think Barcelona is a Ferrari track as much as everyone else is saying it is.
Yeah, so that's the second thing we agree on. I'm also not 100% sure why Jensen and everyone says it, but they've said it and whatever, you know, there's a lot of things that we don't know.
Your problem is taking Jensen Button seriously. That's your number one problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was just surprised and he said it with such confidence and I thought, but then, you know, it's not just him. I've seen people online, but anyway, it doesn't matter. I've been wrong about a lot of things in this sport. But I asked you how you were enjoying the season. I'm interested also in how did you feel about the spectacle that was Miami? I have to get your opinion on this. I think this is one of the things that has divided everyone. Yeah.
Personally, I enjoyed Miami. I'm not going to lie. Everything about it was literally the U.S. Like, you can't go to the U.S. and not get that spectacle. We see it on Qatar, but just, like, not in... And, like, we don't see it in abundance like we saw it in Miami. I mean, Miami is, like, a vacation spot, you know, and it's, like, where celebrities always hang out or whatever. So we were going to... Like, Miami is the Monaco of the U.S. So I don't understand what people... I don't understand what people were expecting to see at Miami. Like, were they expecting to see a Barcelona build-up? Or, like, what? I don't understand. Like, personally, I enjoyed every theatric... I mean, the dramatic podium, I didn't actually watch it, but, like, before I switched off the TV, I saw, like, there was, like, a police escort or something like that. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. And the celebrities, besides Marcel Brandl's very ignorant grid walk, and that was just a dismal thing where I was suffering from secondhand embarrassment. At first, it was very funny, but then when I watched it and I was just like, you know what, that was actually very rude. I was okay. Like, I don't mind celebrities being on the grid. I don't mind all of that because, after all, Formula One is trying to break into that market. So, of course, the celebrities need to be there. Like, the best way to break into a market is to bring, like, big stars, especially, like, in America. So I just don't understand why people are, like, oh, you know, angry over it. They were like, we want to focus on the racing. I mean, the racing did happen and you didn't see David Beckham punch a tire or anything. So why are you pressed that he was on the grid?
David Beckham didn't punch a tire. That's brilliant. Yeah, I think, yeah, no, I think you've made such good points. I mean, listen, I didn't enjoy it, but I'm also like, I'm not into Formula One for the theatrics anyway, right? So as much as I like didn't enjoy it, I wasn't upset by it. I think I find people who get actively upset a little bit curious. Although I do want to stand up for Martin Brundle, and I know I'm a little bit of a small voice, a lone voice in this one, but I think Brundle. I think it is challenging, and I think we can meet each other halfway. I think there are probably too many celebrities on the grid for the grid walk, but like I think that they should be briefed that like this is something that is likely to happen. I know that you use the word rude. And I'm thinking about that moment with Venus when he just had his microphone and he walked with her with his microphone in her face. And she was just like saying nothing, but I don't think she knew the microphone was there for like 10 seconds. It was that was very, very cringeworthy. You know, I have sympathy with the fact that, you know, whoever was in his ear, gave the one guy was like the wrong name. Like that was really embarrassing. Yeah, but I would like to see a sort of like, let's meet each other halfway, just for that 15 minutes. It's the grid walk is literally 15 minutes, you know, no longer than that. And I think, you know, they can sort of try meet each other halfway. Like if you're going to be on the grid walk, then you know, you can expect to be interviewed by this Formula One person, you know. And Martin Brundle is, you know, genuinely one of the all-time great voices of Formula One. I would just add to that. I do understand your position, I mean, that it was cringe, but you know, potentially rude at times, and it's just awkward. I just, like, you can coordinate these things better, I think.
I mean, I hear you, and yes, celebrities can be briefed about how they'll be interviewed by, you know, a Sky Sports pundit, which is okay. But all I'm saying is, him as a person as well, he should actually sit down and try to educate himself and just try to learn all these people's names, what they do, whatever. Because before we went into the race, there were confirmed celebrities that we all knew were coming. So you, as a, I would like to believe that as a pundit, you sit down, you're like, oh, who has a pundit who has a segment that features a lot of celebrities, you know. I'd like to believe that you'd sit down and learn what they do, who they are, you know, learn the different names. Because he even passed, he didn't even know Dwayne Wade. Gabriella Union's husband. Oh my god, I'm just like Martin Brundle. I'm so embarrassed.
But yeah, well done there, Martin. How are you enjoying the race?
But yeah, all I'm saying is the least that he could do as well in terms of meeting them halfway is just learning their names, what they do, and what they're known for. Literally, it's so simple. And Formula One fans that were all that were like throwing the quotes, like the toys out of the cart yesterday, was just so annoying. Like, how are you trying to gatekeep an elite, like an elite sport from the elite? Like, how is that really? Like, how does that make sense to you? Like, you keep on saying that these people are ruining everything, but they're not ruining everything. It's not like these people are going up and down and like stealing parts from like this, from a Red Bull car and like taking them to a Mercedes car. These people are just there walking around taking pictures and going back to like the paddock and just the hospitality room. That's it. So I don't get the argument. But then also, a very fascinating thing that was happening was between the Americans and the Europeans. You know, Europeans and Americans are always fighting, and especially when it comes to like races in their countries. In their countries where Europeans think they're so much better than Americans in terms of like racing and everything, or like the circuits and everything. And the Americans are just there like, we don't care. We're just happy that we have a race here. And literally, Americans don't care about anything else but just enjoying the races. So Europeans are actually pissed off at that, which is the funniest thing, because I just feel like you guys are both colonizers, you know, like you can, at the least you can do is like get along.
Yeah, I think their history, their you know, their respective histories, and what they've done throughout the world makes them think that they're similar, but they're not. You know, I was thinking about something that you were saying just a little bit about, like, you've got to sort of embrace culture. And although, you know, America is like an English-speaking country, they've got a very different culture to the UK, for example. And we quickly recognize culture when I say, I'm talking we, I mean Formula One in general. When Formula One goes to the Middle East, for example, then we're suddenly very aware of cultural nuances and differences, and people will, you know, there will be discussions whether or not they do it around the appropriate things to wear, etc. And I think the mistake that a lot of people make is assuming that because America is English speaking, that, you know, they're just like the UK or anything like that. Meanwhile, they're not. They're nothing like it. And I think if you see it from the lens of leaning into a particular culture, like, we're racing in the United States, this is how things happen here, then, you know, you'd probably be a lot less angry every day. I don't know. Use it, don't use it, guys. That's just, yeah.
With that being said, like, I genuinely just enjoy American races, besides the time zones. I hate, like, a late night race or whatever. But I think I just enjoy the atmosphere and how Lewis is so celebrated there. Like, he's seen as a celebrity. And you don't get this hostility that he gets in, like, European countries. Like, he was being celebrated all weekend. And you could also tell that he was at his happiest day. So, give me 15 American races. I don't care. I don't mind. I will watch them just so I can see Lewis being celebrated.
No, I think that's fair. I'll watch them because Max has now gone back to back in the United States. So we can both be happy.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
No, that's probably a good place to leave this. You know, and guys, thanks for listening. If you're here with us, you know, after an hour and 5 minutes, we've not been around for a little bit. We realize that, but you know, we really appreciate your support. People are saying some really, really nice things on Twitter. We're having some good things happening in the background, and over the next few weeks and months, we're really excited to share not just what we have planned for the podcast and for this platform and things that are sort of simmering in the background. Thank you so much for the support. We really, really appreciate it. Wama, any last words? We don't have a race this weekend. We don't have a race this weekend coming, but yeah.
Thank God for that. And with that being said, I just know everyone is here to listen to me and not Langa. So thank you guys for supporting me. Me. I really appreciate your support. We really have a few amazing things that we have lined up. And yeah, things that we're just working on. And just opportunities that are coming to us. So just really, really thankful for just like you guys' patience and like your support. It just genuinely means a lot to us because we're just two people who are obsessed with Formula One, who like live and breathe the sport. So we just are glad that you guys enjoy hearing us banter and talk about it like this. You know, at least this is our therapy, because I think if we didn't have this platform, we'd probably be like intense therapy, because the sport does send you to therapy. I, for one, know that. But yeah, guys, thank you for listening and see you next week. Oh, no, in 2 weeks' time. Sorry,
yeah.
In 2 weeks.
You know what you should try? Yeah. 2 weeks' time. You know what you should try? Watch some tennis. Tennis is fun. Love that sport. I'm in my tennis era as well. I think that's why I'm so much at peace these days.
No, I'm not doing that. I'm not taking up any other sports. I mean, football is trying to kill me sometimes, and I'm not even invested in that. So I'm not going to take up another sport so I can be more depressed. Formula One is doing all of that on its own. It's doing a great job at depressing me. So thank you very much.
All right. I think on that note, that's it. And yeah, we'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
Bye, guys.